Couple of weeks ago, I was asked to contribute something to one of the popular Buddhist journals out there. And I used the opportunity to write a short summary of some of the things we've been talking about over the last few weeks about the nature of the true self. So I thought I would begin today by reading that short piece to you, and then can use that as a basis for some further commentary. So it's called, "Your True Self is Not Deep Inside." Who are you, really? If I ask you who you are, most people will respond by saying what they do for a living, where they live, or say something like, "I'm Sam's father," or "Jessica's partner." These are all perfectly good answers. But what they have in common is they identify you with places, activities, or relationships that all seem to be outside of us as an individual. So we might want to ask, who are you inside? We often feel that who we have to be in public, in front of other people, or when we're doing a job, involves living up to other people's expectations of us, of being who they think we are or should be. We might think of this social self as an accommodative, compliant, or even a false self, to use a term made famous by British psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott. If we live in a society where our natural feelings, opinions, creativity, or sexuality are disapproved of, or are potentially the source of ridicule, shame, or abuse, we may feel we need to hide our true self and keep it hidden inside of us. What we keep hidden may be something positive and precious, like the love of a kind of music that none of our peers or our parents are into. Or it may be some shameful secret we don't want anyone to know, like having been sexually abused by a parent. In either case, just by virtue of being kept hidden away, of being buried deep inside, it comes to be the thing we think of as defining who we really are, the thing I am that nobody sees. It may be as simple as having thoughts I keep entirely to myself and never say out loud to anyone. Or my whole identity can be organized around keeping hidden something that feels absolutely essential to who I am, as when I'm closeted about my sexuality. When we think of ourselves this way, as having a surface, outer, public self, and a private, inner self, we are creating a vertical model of the self. This way of thinking about ourselves is so common and natural, it may be hard to imagine an alternative. But our meditation practice can introduce us to an alternative horizontal picture of ourself, or rather ourselves. If we sit with a simple, open, focused attention, watching, feeling, experiencing whatever comes up, it is as if we see in the mirror of our awareness a whole succession of what Philip Bromberg called self states. Moment by moment, feelings and thoughts pass by in no particular order, displaying the whole variety of the ways I exist to myself, as confident, as anxious, as calm, as worried about what others think, as I remember being a child, as I imagine myself in the future. All these states proceed one after the other, in no particular order, and most importantly, not arranged in any hierarchy. Each one is the me of that moment, to be followed by what may be a completely different me the next. Sometimes it feels like an unchanging me is having a succession of thoughts. But then a different me appears, seemingly unconnected to the first. Depending on your personality style, we may automatically and unconsciously assemble all the various me's into the feeling of a single identity. Or we may allow them to remain mysterious and distinct from one another. What is crucial about this horizontal picture is that there is no basis for any one self to be truer than another. One part of me, a seemingly calm and serene self state, may not at all like it when an angry self state inexplicably shows up. Then the calm state may use meditation to try to extirpate its rival. A particular brand of self-hate that often gets called spirituality.
The more compassion that
our practice should be to allow all of our self-states to coexist, to allow each one of them a place at the table, so to speak, since each of them arises from a genuine, if sometimes painful, part of our past experience. But whether we take a horizontal or vertical perspective, we still may be equating the self with the mind, with something taking place between our ears. Where's the body in this picture? What is the relation of myself to my body? Is myself in my body? Is myself identical with or separate from my body? Throughout history, there have been those for whom the very concept of spirituality was grounded in the possibility of separating the spirit from the body, forgetting perhaps the root of spirit in the body's breath. Can there be a breath, a spirit, without a breathing body? Yes, they promised, the spirit can be separated from its bodily container, be purified of its bodily needs and vulnerabilities, exist beyond the death of the body, continuing into another life through cycles of reincarnation or in transcendent, heavenly, or if you're not careful, hellish realms. There have been those who teach us, you are not your body, you are not your thoughts, you are not your feelings, you are not your sensations. Seeking to identify the true self with some sort of pure awareness emptied of its contents. But in my particular Zen tradition, at least, we see the body as the perfect expression of the Dharma and view the mind as uncontaminated by its contents, whether thoughts or feelings. Zen is not a purification process. Our most fundamental realizations of impermanence and interdependence are continuously displayed by the body as it changes, as it ages, by its vulnerability to conditions of heat and cold, its need for food and drink, not to speak of our social, interdependent needs for nurture, community, and love. When Ehe Dogen spoke of the identity of practice and realization, the body, seated in Zazen, was not just the vehicle for our realization, not a part of the means we employ to achieve enlightenment, but the ongoing expression of that realization, the way we performatively are Buddhas. For Dogen, the activity of Zazen is the expression of our true self. Not because it is bringing forth our true self from deep inside, but because in sitting, we are enacting the moment-to-moment reality of emptiness. Everything we do, everything we are, can't help but enact that reality. One might say that everything we do is the perfect expression of who we are in that moment. The action is the true picture of the soul. Nothing is hidden. It has all come to this. The self as it is, comprised of multiple shifting self states, co-created by its world and its relations, is already, just as is the body, an ongoing expression of the Dharma, of the joint realities of impermanence and interdependence. We do not have to discover a true self somewhere deep inside. Our true self has been hiding in plain sight all along. It is nothing but our ordinary self experienced from the perspective of emptiness. Nothing needs to change. But that insight changes everything. Now I'll say a few words of commentary on my own writing, an unusual opportunity. I'll begin by recalling that Joko, in Everyday Zen, says that our true self isn't something, but rather it's the absence of something. But I think that what we have to keep looking at is the way in which this practice, which is really about over and over again investigating and experiencing what our self is, how tempting it is, or how seemingly universal it is, to turn that practice instead into the cultivation or discovery of an alternate self, a true self, a higher self, something that's supposed to be behind or underneath this ordinary self that gives us so much trouble we're so unsatisfied with that we put ourselves through this rigorous practice. Really, what we're doing here is just to understand and experience the nature of the self that we already have, to experience, as Buddha did, its emptiness and interconnection. The temptation is to say that when we experience those things, what happens is that we somehow plug into a whole other self, a self that's more real than the one we have, one that participates in a whole different kind or level of consciousness. But really what we're doing is simply investigating the myriad possibilities, all the myriad different states that are possible in the self that we have. I think that we long for a kind of self that is purified of its suffering, of its emotion, of its vulnerability. And so often, all those qualities have been identified with the body's needs, the body's desires, the body's vulnerability. And the whole history of religion, East and West, is often a kind of attempt to purify the spirit of its bodily attributes. And yet what I've tried to say in this piece and what I write about over and over again is there is no spirit separate from the body. There is no mind separate from the body. That our awareness, our consciousness, is an aspect of our functioning body, just as is our breathing. And that this is not a problem to be overcome, but a reality to be explored and in the end appreciated. It's very easy to, in some way, fetishize moments of pure consciousness, as if those good moments of sitting, when it seems that our mind is calm, thought or feeling free, that sense of, oh, for just that moment, the mirror is empty, bright and clear. If that, that is our underlying true self. And if only we could keep it that way all the time. But that's just yet another self state. And our goal is to come to terms with the messy ones, not to simply maximize the ones we're most comfortable with. We can talk about being in the moment, but it turns out we're pretty fussy about the moments we want to be one with. The true self, the empty self, the self we already have, to see that as empty is to see it both as momentary and conditioned, as the sum of everything that's gone before it. Literally, it has all come to this. Being in the moment is not something where our history is completely erased and we see the world fresh with new eyes, as if we were just born again in this moment, a moment after moment. Somebody sent me a little article about a research study in which an attempt to study the neurological basis of perception, these scientists somehow hooked up brain scans to newborn baby rabbits. And so they were there waiting with their brain scan the very first time the baby rabbit ever was given a carrot. And so the baby rabbit, for the first time in its life, smells a carrot. And there they see these characteristic brain waves, on their scan. Then they give the baby rabbit a banana to smell, and a whole new set of little brain waves shows up on the scan. But then the interesting part is they show the baby rabbit another carrot. And this time, when the rabbit smells the carrot, it doesn't simply have a repeat of the brain waves the first time, but its brain waves have been altered because now it's had the experience of both carrot and banana. That even the most simple thing, when we experience it, is experienced as a product of everything we've experienced before this. One way of describing that is to say all perception is apperception, that we don't build up our world from lots and lots of little micro dots of perceptions, but that every perception in some way is experienced as part of a whole that is constantly changing on the basis of the next round of inputs. So, but we experience our worlds, not sense data. But those worlds are always shifting, always changing. And we are changing with it. We are those worlds. What we're doing in this practice is settling in to this life world, the world that shows up to us moment after moment, the world that is the totality of all our experiences up to this moment, a world that we can try to control or try to narrate, but which one way or another both comes to us whole and comes to us constantly changing, and constantly the result of the input of everybody else and everything else that's happening moment after moment. This is what we're present to. This is who we are. This is our true self. This is no self. This is life as it is.